Welcome back. So, is there a gravity propulsion system that is capable of solving our environmental energy crisis? Joining next is David Sarita. He studied a paranormal psychology and physics for over 25 years. He has found what he calls the evidence of UFOs using a gravity propulsion system based on a NASA video he's going to share with us. And he's going to talk about the revolutionary vortex wave frequency model that he calls the galaxy clock. When we come back, this is Coast to Coast AM. You're listening to Lisa Garr, and we will be right back. Welcome back. Joining me is David Sarita. He's a filmmaker and a mystic ecologist, and he has tested faster than light energies and higher vortex dimensional states of matter where communications and spacecraft can travel faster than the speed of light. And this is just fascinating to me. Welcome to the show, David. Thank you for joining me.
Hi, Lisa. Thanks for joining me tonight and having me on the show.
I'm excited. I've lot to learn here. And so let's just dive right into talking about some of the hidden power of the vortex and what exactly it is that you have discovered and rediscovered.
Well, what happened for me was in 19, the year 2000, just as we were coming to the millennium, I was living in an apartment in Vancouver, British Columbia. And on the night the millennium had passed and I had saved up all this food and, we thought Y2K was going to collapse our computers and nothing happened. And on the night of January the 10th, which is a very auspicious night for me, I'll explain in a minute. I had gone through a deep, deep mystical experience that allowed me to see full 3D spiritual beings, space beings, star beings, deceased family members. And it was so incredible to really see them with my eyes. So what was about to happen wasn't so shocking that I was seeing them, but it's what they were going to teach me. So these three beings of bright light, their faces were so bright that you couldn't really see their faces very well. And they had gold cords and white robes, and they just flashed into my mind this vortex mathematical model that could explain black holes, mini black holes, subatomic particles, and how you can travel faster than the speed of light from our solar system to another star system, and how you can telecommunicate faster than the speed of light. And the information was transferred to me in a matter of seconds.
Was it numbers or pictures or what did you see?
It's a picture. It's
pictures.
It's a model I call the Galaxy Clock, and I put it in my first DVD, Evidence: The Case for NASA UFOs. And I was on Coast to Coast with Art Bell in those days, and we put it on the internet, and it just got millions of people viewing it. And people were calling me up and contacting me because they said they understood it. They understood the model. And the model clearly showed how a spiral vortex formed in a galaxy, in an atom. And it also showed a third force that actually broke the speed of light. And you could see it visually. You could actually see it visually. And I was explaining this on this chalkboard in this first DVD I did. And I didn't really know what was going to happen next because I was like, how, why me? Why is this happening to me? I mean, I was a tree planter, a deep, deep meditator, had been meditating for years and years of my life and doing environmental work. And
had you been dabbling in these energies before, or?
Well, yeah, that's a good question. Yes, I had. I actually worked for a nuclear physicist named Bogdan Castle-Magwitch, who was an MIT physicist. And I read an article in Omni magazine, the science magazine back then, that talked about this physicist from MIT who had discovered a way to produce environmentally friendly fusion energy, igniting helium-3 fuel. And Magwitch had invented a vortex magnetic field chamber, and he slid a beam of this non-radioactive helium-3 fuel at such a precise angle that when the fuel bounced off of the magnetic field, it produced this beautiful flower of life design. And he called it Mi'kmaq, which means mixture in Greek. And Magwitch wanted to save the world. He wanted to end, energy shortages for poor countries in Africa. And that was kind of his inspiration. And I met him. He moved to Southern California, and I started working with him In about 1993, 94. Earlier than that, 92, 93.
Mm-hmm.
And I started to get to know his technology. So I started to see what he was doing. And there was something about the vortex, the way he was spinning his magnetic field, that allowed him to produce a temperature in a nuclear fusion device that is so high, 10 billion degree ion temperature.
Wow.
It's hotter than the sun's 37 million degrees. So I mean, the whole world was looking at him saying, this is impossible because we're spending billions of dollars on toroidal, means mm-hmm. donut-shaped fusion reactors at Princeton University, and we're only getting 100 million degrees. You know, what is it with this guy? He's only spent a few million. And back in those days, a Saudi prince and Royal Dutch Shell had spent a few million dollars on the research. So I came in, and I was introducing him to the head of Southern California Edison, a big public utility in the L.A. area, and its president, John Bryson, sends in his junior physicist, Glenn Duckett, to come and meet us. And so he comes in, and he looks at me, and he goes, David, do you know who all these people are? I mean, these are the greatest scientists in the world that are in this room. You know, Glenn Seaborg, who chaired the Atomic Energy Commission under Kennedy, Johnson, and Nixon, was there. And Murray Gell-Mann, who is considered one of the greatest physicists, and Einstein was there. They're all in the room. And I thought, this is great. Edison is impressed. They're going to invest in this, and we're going to change the world. And so what happened from that point on is every possible thing the U.S. government could do to squash it, they did. We spoke in Congress. We fought them. Every time we had money or big corporations interested in it, they told those companies and called them up and said, stay away from this, because this little mini reactor, a cubic meter, could produce a billion watts of power in one square meter with no radiation using the helium-3 fuel. But it was the vortex that was so special.
Well, now, what did the government do, though? I mean, they stopped your production of this, or...
Well, whenever I had serious money people interested in putting it, we were only looking for $10 million to complete it. And at that time, I was regularly in contact with NASA's head of propulsion power and energy, Dr. Earl Van Landingham, who was a German, you know, rocket scientist who has been with NASA forever. And Earl Van Landingham, and he spent hours on the phone with me saying, you know, we need this because this little miniature fusion reactor could not only produce environmentally benign energy, but it could produce nuclear propulsion speeds of a tenth the speed of light, which is about 67 million miles an hour. That'd get us to Mars really fast. I mean, super fast compared to what we're doing now.
Mm-hmm.
And 10 million seemed really like nothing. So I think it was 1993 or 94, I spoke in Congress as director of the Tesla Foundation, among many Nobel laureates were speaking that day, to ask Congress, look, I mean, if you're going to block all corporations from funding this, why don't you fund it? And Al Gore was supposed to be there that day. His actor friend Harry Hamlin from L.A. Law was with us. And, you know, we thought, you know, Gore's going to do it. He's going to get behind it. And Gore didn't even show up that day for the hearings in the House. So I spoke, we all spoke, and they basically just heard us and said, I remember the speaker of the subcommittee on energy, and I'm trying to remember the name of the committee, telling me, you know, we just can't fund every idea that comes along. And I said, what do you mean? I mean, we've got signatures from multiple Nobel Prize winners.
Right, this isn't every idea.
This isn't every idea. Mm-hmm. We've already spent millions on testing, and we're getting mm-hmm. positive results. I mean, Magwitch has higher temperatures than you need a billion degrees to fuse helium-3 fuel. And he had 10 billion degrees. He was hotter than anybody's nuclear fusion device. So the whole thing collapsed. And for me, I mean, Magwitch didn't, he knew about my spiritual path and some of the mystical experiences I had had. But somehow we really bonded. And he went on to find a new way to detect hidden landmines in the soil. And I became president of that company and worked with him for many more years, and well, we tried to fund this vortex fusion device.
And it didn't, it never really got off the ground, so to speak.
It never got off the ground, and that was in the 90s. So this is, you know, the turn of the millennium, and it's, you know, I'm in this apartment. And Magwitch is from Yugoslavia, which is where Nikola Tesla is from, and Tesla, of course, is the scientist who invents the Tesla coil and He's the true father of radio. The Supreme Court ruled on June 21st, 1943, that Tesla, Lodge, and Stone were the fathers of radio, and Marconi was working as a lab assistant and had stole it from Tesla. So Magwitch was this new Tesla. You know, he was from the same country, and he helped bring over the Tesla Memorial to Niagara Falls and Westinghouse Corporation. And so there he was. I thought this man was going to change the world. And nothing really changes in the world unless everybody decides to get behind it.
Right. And
that did not happen. So here I was. One of the three angelic beings of light was Tesla. And I felt him and saw him, and he was teaching me a way deeper level of the vortex than had ever been understood, because there was this faster-than-light component. And this is really deep stuff, Lisa, so I can't really explain it all in the air, but I can tell you that, but taking a course with me and watching this video, you can clearly see where faster-than-light energies are generated, how black holes are generated, how the spiral arms of the Milky Way galaxy are created. You can see them actually being created.
It's fascinating. I've watched the video, and it's fascinating. It's on YouTube, and you can also watch it. So this explains that these faster-than-light energies create these zero-point wormholes, right?
Well, what starts to happen, it really gets deeper and deeper and deeper, and we're going to go so deep into the vortex here. We're going to make, you know, our current understanding of vortexes seem like we don't know anything. And it's really mind-blowing. We might even be able to explain how an airliner the size of a Boeing 777 can disappear through a micro wormhole that is super, super powerful. But so what happens next is, you know, this guy named Martin Stubbs is a program manager of a Shaw Cable in Vancouver. And through a mutual friend of mine, Mike Boyle, he gets me these tapes of the space shuttle mission STS-75, which was February and March of 1996. And there's this videography, where the space shuttle is using cameras that can see invisible light that the human beings don't usually see. And I had been a professional photographer for, you know, 20 years at that point, and I had won awards in photography and had gallery showings of my work. I was a fine art black and white printer. And I understood cameras, but I was having these regular experiences after this massive experience in the year 1986, the end of 86, December 22nd, 23rd, where I left my body and I go and I'm traveling at superluminal speed, which means faster than light speed, journeying through the vortex spirals of the Milky Way galaxy, and I'm going to the middle of the galaxy and I'm hearing angels singing louder than thunder and torrential ecstasy. And after that experience, to make that experience shorter, I saw my first spirit. I saw my first spirit with my eyes open, and that was my Aunt Patsy Cooper, who was my stepfather's sister, and, you know, my brother's full aunt. And I was bonded really well with Patsy Cooper. She was an amazing woman. She was at a Buddhist retreat in San Francisco with some high Tibetan lamas, and she died of a brain aneurysm and just dropped dead. Now, no one told me in the family. It had just happened. And I think that was January the 11th. It might have been January the 11th, which is really weird because, you know, getting the 10th or the 11th is when she died of that year. And all of a sudden, I'm on my writing partner Michael Mann's couch in Los Angeles, and we're writing this Tesla script. And I feel this woman touching my legs, and I'm sleeping on the couch. You know, we're doing these long writing sessions, and I stayed over. And I thought, who's touching my leg? Is that his wife? I was laughing. And I get up, and I'm seeing this full, clear, this young, beautiful woman with long, dark hair and this violet strip of light around her. And she's floating a foot off the floor, and she's looking into my eyes, and my heart's pounding out of my chest. I mean, I'm seeing this for the first time, and I'm like, this is real. I'm really seeing this woman. And I had just been, only weeks before, you know, all the way through the journey through the vortex spiral arms of the Milky Way galaxy, zooming to the middle of the...
And that spiritual experience,
yes. And I figured that gave me the power to see a spirit. And I didn't know who she was, and I was scared. And I said, please leave. I said it telepathically. I'm too scared. I can't deal with it.
Because you, Was it like an eyes wide open type of experience?
Totally wide open. I mean, I'm really seeing it, and it's not fuzzy. It's not blurry. And she floats through the fireplace wall, and I tell my friend Michael Mann the next morning. And see, when you have an experience like that, and then you realize that NASA is using cameras that can see ultraviolet light, and she has this violet strip of light around her.
Yes.
You see, you know you're seeing in this invisible spectrum of light, and that's how you're doing it. So how can a camera do that? Well, I knew all these scientists at NASA from Maglitch, so I started writing them letters and sending the footage, and I said, you know, what camera are you using? And I got a letter, which I've never shown the world to this date, in this huge debate over this photography. James Olber goes on the show with me and Art Bell years ago in the year 2000, and he's saying it's an ordinary video camera. And I said, no, it isn't. This camera has been retrofitted by the military to see near and far ultraviolet light. Ultraviolet light is near, far, and extreme, so there's three levels of it.
Very far, though. I mean, that would have to reach out.
Far UV means there's no camera available to the public today that can see far UV.
It would have to have like a laser technology to it.
They use a special CCD sensor that has certain chemicals on the plane that absorb ultraviolet light to do it.
I see. Okay.
So there we were. We're seeing these UFOs, and the UFOs are giant. They're floating behind a 12-mile-long, quarter-mile-wide neon tube tethered satellite, which is floating in space. And the tether is a quarter mile wide because the experiment that NASA was doing when they were dragging this 12-mile-long antenna basically through the ionosphere, which is the charged part of our atmosphere, to see if they could get free electricity to power the space station, right? Because they were starving for energy up there, and solar panels just weren't enough.
So, it wasn't fast enough, yeah. Mm-hmm.
It wasn't enough power to do the experiments they wanted to do. And there's Earl Van Landingham at NASA telling me, David, I mean, we can get a billion-watt power source.
Right,
you know, we don't need these stupid solar panels up here, which they're still using.
Right. Crazy. Which is, you know, it's very, very slow compared to what you had discovered.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and what Maglitch had discovered. So what's happening now is I'm involved in this conspiracy at NASA, and everyone's trying to shut me up. And Art Bell's radio show was shut down. All the broadcasts, the whole thing shut down, the whole coast-to-coast shut down that night. It wasn't working. He was just recording the argument between me and James Olber. Well, you know, it became kind of legend, and our video got millions of views on YouTube. And in the video, I'm explaining this galaxy clock. Well, what happens is I go to Maui, and my friend Steve Okerlund there, who's this amazing zero-point energy scientist, who was being funded by Joe Firmage, who was all over the news because he was this young billionaire, who was spending all his money on UFOs and anti-gravity research, and NASA was really disturbed about that he was doing that. And it was on the San Francisco Chronicle, was breaking headlines around the world, this billionaire is going to start funding anti-gravity and UFO stuff. Oh, my God, you know, we're going to have competition, and we don't like this. Well, Steve, you know, with his funding, got this amazing VCR player, because back then NASA had this on VHS tape. And it allowed us to go frame by frame, which you cannot do in the digital footage on the video on YouTube that you guys have up right now.
Oh, you can't?
You can't go frame by frame in digital.
Digital, right.
It all, because the source was VHS. And you can see these pulsing waves coming from this UFO that is at least 2 or 3 miles wide. It's basically a mothership.
Wow.
And because the tether is 12 miles long and it's a quarter mile thick because it's ionized with all these gases that leaked out of the satellite mysteriously, which NASA says is impossible unless someone threw a switch, and nobody threw the switch, so they don't know who did it.
You would think one switch wouldn't have that tire capability, right?
Yeah, it emptied the nitrogen fuel tank, and they didn't do it. And that gathered around the electrostatic tether, this antenna, and produced a neon tube effect. So you got this 2-mile-wide UFO sitting there, and it's pulsing. And we zoom in, and there's a vortex spiral coming out of a mini black hole in the center of the UFO.
Much like the same one that you had found with the zero-point wormholes and the different types of energies that you found with the galaxy clock, right?
It, I could read it
identical
with the math and the vortex galaxy clock that Nikola Tesla and the other beings taught.
We have to take a quick break, David. We'll be right back with David Cerita. My guest tonight is David Cerita. We're talking about a space shuttle mission that it's the STS-75 that happened 1996, sometime through February through March of 96, where they believe that UFOs were captured on a space shuttle video, and the cameras revealed one of the largest UFOs ever captured on video of all time. And these cameras that were capable of seeing invisible ultraviolet light at great distances. And when you zoom into the footage, David found this vortex energy wave similar to that he discovered through a channeling of beings that came in that described the galaxy clock to him. So we will continue on with David Cerita when we come back to find out more. Welcome back. This is Lisa Garr. My guest is David Cerita, and we're talking about the faster-than-light energies that David was discovering that make zero-point wormholes and explain black holes. And you were getting into explaining this 12-mile-long antenna that was sent out to capture these photos. So if you could continue on, David, to tell us about these 2 to 3 mile wide UFOs that were captured, and they simulated this exact same energy, this vortex that you discovered with the galaxy clock, right?
Yeah, which can't be a coincidence that I would be discovering this, you know, that this information falls into my hands. And I'm looking at this thing, you know, this is photographic proof of what Tesla had taught me in the light experience in the year 2000 on January the 10th. And Tesla died in the Hotel New Yorker in New York on January the 7th going into the 8th or the 9th. So the date is almost identical to his death as an anniversary. And we don't keep 100% accurate time on this planet to cosmic time, so I mean, it literally could have been his true birthday, you know, of the anniversary of his death.
Interesting.
And I was formerly, you know, the director of the Tesla Foundation and had spoken in Congress in 1994, I think that was. So that was before. And this is the year 2000. So everything has changed. And where this goes, where this starts to go is so mind-bending. It's so mind-bending that it gets to the point where you're just not going to believe what happens next. Every year I would go and work for this physicist, you know, Dr. Magwitch, and I got paid, but I was also a tree planter in Canada, and it was part of my dharma and my spiritual practice and my daily meditation that I've maintained for 35 years to do something actual for the environment that was going to make a difference.
Mm.
So I'd go tree planting, and this particular year, 1994, which is right around the time I was starting to privately, you know, write NASA letters about the NASA UFOs that we were seeing, and I wasn't public about it at all. At that point, the government had decided that I owed them $1,000, and they took all of my $20,000 in tree planting earnings for that entire year out of my bank account and left me penniless. And my dad had this ranch in Topanga, California, with horses and renovating a house, and I pitched a tent in the dirt. And I had a company called the Green and Blue Corporation where we were trying to raise the money for Magwitch's fusion. We met literally the richest people on the planet. And my good friend, Nancy Pfister in Aspen, Colorado, was helping me meet these richest people face to face. And they were all saying no, like nobody wanted to give us this measly $10 million to change the world.
Why?
It was really amazing, like the answers I got. I even met with Michael Jackson's partner, Brett Strong, and he wouldn't let us, you know, we knew him really well, and he wouldn't give us the meeting with Michael Jackson. We're like, he's going to love this. This is going to change the world.
Mm-hmm.
And I met with George Stranahan, who owned Champion Spark Plugs and had $300 million liquid cash at that time. He wouldn't do it, and he was Nancy Sister's godfather. I mean, Nancy spent a lot of time with me. She was from one of the richest families in Aspen, and we met, you know, billionaires, you know, 100 millionaires. And it didn't matter where I went.
What was the reason they were giving you?
It's like if it's not on CNN, and it was, Magwitch did make headlines. The guy should have won the Nobel Prize in physics. I mean, all his friends were Nobel Prize winners. But what had happened, it got pretty sinister. Glenn Seaborg, who was chairman of the Atomic Energy Commission under Kennedy, Johnson, and Nixon, was inside the company. And secretly, the nuclear lobbyists, the nuclear weapons lobbyists, see, they get their nuclear weapons fuel from the breeder nuclear power plant reactors, because you need a reactor, a nuclear power plant, to breed plutonium from uranium for bombs, and you also need tritium for hydrogen bombs. What they were arguing in Congress was, if you have a non-radioactive nuclear power plant and all the utilities buy these, where are we going to get our weapons fuel? So it looked like Seaborg was on our side, but he was kind of like a spy on the inside.
Mm-hmm.
And you won't believe this, but Howard Hughes and Seaborg knew each other, because Howard Hughes had moved to Las Vegas, Nevada, for very mysterious reasons that you won't even believe. Howard Hughes, you know, we knew him because Magwitch knew him when his company and his research was younger, and he wanted to fund Magwitch. He would have changed the world, Howard Hughes. What happened is Glenn Seaborg was basically in a war against Howard Hughes because of why Howard Hughes was really there, which I believe had to do with Area 51. And the ET craft and the reverse engineering, because he's an aerospace man and he wants to know everything about flying and he wants to take the next step. He wants to know how anti-gravity works.
Right. Very big into inventing. Yes.
And in fact, while they were testing nuclear weapons in Nevada, Seaborg was authorizing these nuclear, it's called the NTS. The Nevada test site was doing nuclear rocket propulsion systems way back then. And what happens is Howard Hughes is ready to sign the check to Magwitch. This all gets really nasty. Howard Hughes, the whole story about Howard Hughes is really a lie. I know that the people who were closest to him, they wanted me to write the book on their lives, on the real story of what had happened. John Meyer was very close to Hughes. You know, he was running for president in the United States. He told me that Howard Hughes was fine. That was an actor they had in there. The real Howard Hughes was taken out of the hotel in a helicopter, and the guy who was dying, the reason no one could see him is because it wasn't him. And Hughes was getting too close to something, and it might have been Magwitch's fusion power, and it might have been Area 51. We don't know. But I was driving Glenn Seaborg to the airport one day, and this is the man who authorized all the nuclear testing. He's the father of the bomb. He's the one. He won the Nobel Prize with Macmillan for the discovery of plutonium, the explosive uranium isotope that becomes plutonium that leads to all these bombs. And Seaborg was like Darth Vader. And I'm in the car with him. And I told him I knew Meyer, John Meyer. Howard Hughes is one of his closest aides. And I said, what happened to him? And he started shaking. Seaborg was shaking, and he says, damn him, he almost stopped all of our nuclear weapons testing. How? Well, that would explain what Meyer told me, is they got, Hughes was taken away. We don't know whether they let him die in peace under a different name and made him stay away from Area 51. We don't know if they got rid of him because they didn't want him to do this non-radioactive nuclear energy with Magwitch, but I know for certain, because Meyer was living in exile in Canada. He couldn't cross the U.S. border, or they'd throw him in prison because of what he knew. So I was in the middle of all this, and I'm just like the storyteller, and I was working for them trying to get their money, and we couldn't get the money. It didn't matter who. You know, I approached Sally Field and Jane Fonda, and Fonda just wrote me this nice rejection letter. But, you know, celebrities are very far removed from reality. I mean, they only know things that are quite popular.
Well, they're careful to get involved in politics,
right?
And yeah, this type of thing. Uh-huh.
Yeah, I mean, I thought with all the Nobel Prize winners supporting us, it would be very clear. So I declined to write the story of Howard Hughes, but I'm saying it for the first time in full on Coast to Coast AM, what I know. This is personal. I knew Seaborg. Seaborg was so mad at me because I published a small article in a small magazine exposing him, and he died. And I knew some of the last living Manhattan Project scientists who built the atomic bomb, all of them before they died, and got a lot of their secrets before the end. But I can tell you things happened that will that are so mind-bending that when Roswell happened on July 7th or 8th, 1947, that when they tested the atomic bombs, a vortex wormhole opens up in the local space. And see, remember, and that you get time dilation because of the warping of gravity in the vortex when you detonate these nuclear weapons. And what, see,
wow.
The Roswell accident, this is what I think happened. I searched every FBI file on every UFO sighting in this country after we tested the first atomic bomb on July 22nd, 1943, in right there in New Mexico, at the nuclear test site in New Mexico, first bomb. Now, why is it that just a few years later, 1945, it was 1943 was the discovery of the plutonium. So 1945 is the test. 2 years later, there's three crashes in and around the origin point of the nuclear blast. And in June of 47, Ken Arnold is seeing these UFOs in up in Washington, you know, near Mount Rainier. There are reports of kids, I'm saying teenage kids, who built and tested anti-gravity flying saucers in Los Angeles. There's an FBI report where this kid on Magnolia Boulevard, he built a flying saucer and test flew it the day of the Roswell incident, July the 8th, and it flew. It was anti-gravitic. He worked at Chevron, which existed back then, and the saucer got too hot and caught on fire and landed in this woman's yard, and they got pictures of it.
And this is around the same time?
But why the same day? Because
right.
This is what I believe happened. I've never said this before. That a vortex opened on the detonation of the atomic bomb. These ETs came through the wormhole, and there was time dilation, which is why 2 years later the crashes happened in and around the hole as it was closing. They only had so much time to teach us a technology that would prevent us from where we're at now. The total destruction of the environment with fossil fuels and nuclear energy and Fukushima and all of it.
And this was around the same time that you started to receive these experiences with them, right?
Well, I started, you know, I was born in 1961, and I saw a UFO in Berkeley in 1967 or 68, very clear, and everybody was watching it that day. And I watched this thing blink out into a micro wormhole. I mean, a full-size saucer just shrinking down into a dot and punching through a hole in the fabric of space-time, and it's gone. And then in the following days, these Palladian beings were showing me how their spaceship worked at 7 years old, and the clockwise and counterclockwise spinning lights and the anti-gravity drive, and they were very kind. They were very loving, human.
Did you understand it?
I thought I did, and my mom was in the middle of divorcing my psychologist father, Lynn Sarita, this, you know, meditator, you know, getting his PhD in the healing effects of meditation and deep relaxation, and she marries a science teacher, David Cooper. So I was David Cooper for, you know, nearly a decade with all my four brothers. So I was getting all this science orientation from David Cooper and my spiritual background from my real dad.
A perfect combination.
And I didn't know about UFOs. There was no ufology in 1968. I didn't know about UFO conferences that were going on out at Giant Rock in California. I was a kid. I watched Star Trek.
But the experience that when you saw that with other friends started this lifelong pursuit of you wanting to capture this information, to find out more about it.
Become obsessed. Like, mm-hmm. I've replayed the movie of the UFO and my memories of them with me, the Palladians, and they don't call their star system Palladians. They showed me what it looked like, and when I used to play hide and go seek and kick the can, I would look at the Palladians when I'm counting to 100. But I had nothing to relate it to. I couldn't tell my brothers much. I mean, there was no UFO
right.
news. It was like my little secret.
Not anymore.
Well, so this gets really amazing, Lisa, because what happens next, I'm looking at this vortex coming out of the UFO, but I understand it. I understand that it's not a white phenomenon. There were people and even UFO hunters tried to disprove the NASA tether incident as fuzzy, airy discs of light on the video camera. But all of that is impossible with CCD cameras. You can see this during a football game. You can see a drop of water on the lens in focus at the same time the game in the background is in focus. That's because with CCD cameras and these video cameras, the depth of field, which means how deep the field of focus is flawless. Whereas an old camera, you would zoom in on something in the distance, and something in the foreground would actually disappear. So NASA, some people at NASA were scientists like Joseph Newts, the third head of the astrochemistry branch at Goddard, was saying that they're just an artifact of the camera. And I said, that's impossible. Look at them. None of them even bump into each other. These aren't every disc. And then I got Louis A. Frank, one of the best physicists NASA has at the University of Iowa. He's a principal investigator on many satellite missions to various planets. And he was already in a conspiracy at NASA for using ultraviolet cameras on space missions to different planets and satellite stations around the Earth. And he was seeing these large, very faint orbs coming into our planet on a regular basis. But he had only seen them on still cameras, and he was so brilliant, he knew how to eliminate whether this is light reflecting off of dust or light.
Oh, he did. Huh.
So I sent him the tapes, and I still wasn't public yet. And Frank wrote me back. He was so excited. He said, I've never seen video of the same objects I've been seeing for years. And everybody's laughing at me at NASA saying that how can there be anything there because you can't see it, but it's in the ultraviolet. And I wrote Edgar Mitchell and had him look at the tape, and he didn't think anything was there either. And I'm like, but Louis A. Frank is so freaking brilliant. You can't even imagine how brilliant Frank is. And Frank said, I'm going to do a full investigation and get back to you, but they're not balls of dust. So all you people out there who think it's been disproved because of UFO hunters, sorry, those guys don't know what they're doing. And when you zoom in and you see the vortex keeps repeating itself. It's a self-repeating three waveforms being captured and pulsing out of this UFO on the camera. And that's impossible. You can't get an in-focus vortex if the camera's producing an out-of-focus blob of light. If it's an out-of-focus blob of light, it means the camera's out of focus.
I understand what you're talking about because I've seen the video, so that makes a lot.
And the Italian astronaut, Claude Nicollier, is saying, I can't adjust the focus any better than that. You can hear it on the NASA camera, which means it's in focus.
Now, wait, how did you get the footage again from this?
Martin Stubbs.
Okay, gave it to you?
He was sitting there at Shaw Cable in Vancouver on the NASA channel and popping tapes in and recording every single mission because he started seeing these things. We have tape of in Space Shuttle Mission STS-80, which is later, showing these very faint, just like Louis A. Frank is saying at the University of Iowa, very faint lights coming in and forming a circle and stopping and locking in positions on a circle, like a crop circle. And you know how in the crop circles, in William Gizecki's film, Crop Circles, The Quest for the Truth, you see this kid on a tractor, and you see this ball of light, very soft-looking, coming up to him, and he falls asleep as soon as the ball of light gets near him, in broad daylight. And, this is where it gets really mind-bending, because what happens to me is I'm in the middle of this investigation, and it's 1994, in the middle of October of 94, when I was broke and I pitched my tent on my dad's land and I didn't know what I was going to do. And, you know, my career with Magwitch was just, you know, starting. You know, I was still just getting going with Magwitch. And I had this experience where there were severe rains in October in Topanga that year. And I got hypothermia, and I started to freeze to death in my tent, floating in about 6 inches of water in a gully. My tent was in a gully.
Oh, this is too good. I want to hear more about this. We have to take a quick break, unfortunately. So you're floating in the gully. We're going to take a quick break. We will come back with you in the gully. David, Sarita, thank you so much. We will be right back. This is Lisa Garr. You're listening to Coast to Coast.